This is Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. This hour, a chow hound reborn. Once upon a time, Jim Leff roamed the restaurant kingdom far and wide in search of the most delectable morsels. He sampled Lebanese pastries in Montreal, corned beef hash in Cape Breton, and lobster rolls in Maine, and that was all in just a couple of months. But the chow hound, as he was known then, has had a kind of revelation. As all of that fine dining took its toll on his waistline and the recession took its toll on restaurants, the chow hound went in search of a better way, and he thinks he's found it. Jim Leff is co-founder of the Chow Hound, now owned by CBS. He's working on several books. He's blogging. We've linked his blog to the Mid-Morning page, and he joins us this morning from Argo Networks in New York. Jim, good to have you back.
Carrie, great to be back.
I want to read a post, just a blast from the past here, from your Chow Tour of 2007. Here's what it said. It's time to wrap up 9 weeks on the road and to account for nearly 8,000 miles driven and several hundred restaurants, bakeries, and noshes sampled in 16 states and 3 Canadian provinces. To quote Johnny Cash, I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere. That didn't sound like such a bad life. What changed?
Well, it sounds good. On the other hand, if you're eating in 11 restaurants a day, even tiny bites here and there, it doesn't leave you loving food that much. And it leaves you, or at least it left me, 35 pounds overweight with high blood pressure, high blood sugar, and high cholesterol, i.e. Wow. on my last legs.
Was it really 11 restaurants in one day sometimes?
Well, you know, I try to do a good job. You know, my corporate overlords who had bought Chow Hound threw me out on the road for 2 months and said, go report every day. And, you know, I'm not just going to, you know, go into a Howard Johnson's and say, I had clams. You know, I'm not a blogger. I'm an old media writer, and I try to find good stuff and write convincingly about it. So everywhere I went, which was like about half of the United States and Canada, it felt like anyway, everywhere I went, I would try really hard to find treasure. That was like the big goal. And I wouldn't stop searching till I found it.
You know, it's interesting to say that you kind of lost your love of food. I've always wondered if that happens with people who do the kind of thing that you do for years and years. Aren't you inevitably going to be jaded in some ways?
I never lost my love of food. I just lost my love of eating.
What's the difference?
When you're eating professionally like that, I mean, it's horrible. Every food critic will tell you when you're researching a book or working on a review, and you know, it's a very unnatural way of eating. You're having to order things that you don't like. You're having to order things that you know are not going to be good just so you can tell if they're good or not. You're eating tiny little bites. Here, let me give you the prototypical moment, okay? I'm in a tobacco field in North Carolina with like no buildings as far as the eye can see, except a little shack where there's a restaurant in the tobacco field. And I go in there and I order fried chicken. They put before me the most beautiful plate of like Snuffy Smith fried chicken, you know, just like jagged and fractal. And I take a bite and it's absolutely sublime. This is my first bite of the day. I generally like breakfast before my fried chicken, but that just doesn't fit what's going on here. Also, I'm still full from yesterday when I was still full from the day before that, when I was still, et cetera, et cetera. So I take a bite of the fried chicken, and with an utterly sour and impassive face, I scroll in my notebook, this is the best fried chicken I've ever had. I put the chicken leg down on the table, I ask for the check, and I leave. You know, that's just not good.
Yeah, you'd lost it, man, by then.
But, you know, I didn't lose my appreciation. I really did think it was the best fried chicken I'd had. I fully appreciated its quality. It just didn't have any meaning for me.
You used to talk, I think the last time you were on the show, we were talking about how you would define deliciousness. And you,
right.
You would say that you were in search of optimal deliciousness, you know, whether it was dining in splendor or grabbing a quick slice. Now, is it true that you believe deliciousness is harder to find these days?
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, I always wonder if just my wacky conclusions are strictly, you know, subjective on my part. So I have a bunch of people I bounce things off of, other chow hounds, and pretty much universally, there's pretty much universal agreement to the fact that it's just not as low on the trees anymore. You know, for 10 years, from like 1995 to maybe like 2005, which coincidentally was also the range that I was running Chahan, there was just this flowering, this outpouring, this zeitgeist of incredible food everywhere. Like you could just blow into any suburb, any strip mall, and if you're a skillful enough Chahan to find the treasure would be there. It would always, always be there. You'd be able to find great stuff. I mean, not just sort of, you know, non-professional, sort of like amateurs who aren't real serious Chahans might think there's nothing to eat, but bring me and my buddies in, we'd find great stuff just about anywhere. But, you know, I think that was a zeitgeist. I think it was just a passing thing. It wasn't like that in the 70s or the 80s, and it doesn't seem to be like it anymore. And I'm not sure it's the recession, which is what everybody says. I think it's just that culture moves on, and the places where great things flower, the different medias, the different, you know, genres and realms, I think they switch around, you know, and I think it's just, I think it's past time, which is not to say there's nothing good to eat, but it's just not this tremendous outpouring anymore.
You know, Jim, I'm really surprised to hear you say that, because you read more and more about chefs turning back to fresh produce. I was just reading a piece in the Times yesterday on their food page about these chefs who are growing produce in their own, you know, restaurant gardens, and they're going out there to harvest it, and that's inspiring the menu. You've got more chefs doing that. Doesn't that contribute to deliciousness?
You bet. That's an awesome thing. But how many percentages of restaurants in this country do that? Maybe 0.001%. And of them, how many are good? Just because you're growing your own produce doesn't mean you really care about how you prepare it. I mean, it could just be a marketing hook. So really, we're talking about, you know, 30 or 40 great places.
You know, it seems like you tell me whether that seems like a trend, or you just think that there are specific restaurants that have really understood how important this is.
Look, for 8 years before I was a restaurant critic, I did the Zagat survey from year one, you know, where you fill out the survey and send it back for a book. And in the write-ins, they would always say, what would you like to see in restaurants? And for 8 years, I said, whole grains and green vegetables. You know, and that was in like the early 80s, and they're finally getting around to it. And it's great. Healthier eating, more conscious, more careful eating. It's just awesome. It's wonderful. On the other hand, again, that's just a tiny, tiny percentage of what's being done. And it doesn't have to be fresh to be good. I mean, look, between you and me, potato chips are about as delicious as food can get. You know, potato chips are wonderful. Corn flakes. I think there's an amnesia that happens as soon as we've eaten a bowl of cornflakes. We forget how great they are. I think if Martians came to Earth and tried cornflakes, they would say, my God, you people are living in heaven. You don't even realize.
Are you kidding me? Of all the foods you're choosing, cornflakes for the aliens?
I'm not saying they're the best thing, but they're ubiquitous and they're great. I mean, people forget how great they are. As soon as you finish the show, go home and eat a bowl of cornflakes and you'll be surprised how good they are.
No, you know what I'm going to go home and eat?
What?
A bowl of chocolate dipped strawberries. Now that is pure heaven, Jim.
God, no, that's really good.
It's but the you know fabulous what fruit and fantastic chocolate.
But here's the thing. Once you eat that, how do you feel afterwards? You sort of get the sugar buzz,
great.
Sort of. Well, I've been paying more attention to how I feel after I eat, sort of like the seventh taste after sweet, sour, bitter, salty, and umami. You know, there's a poorly defined a sense of well-being or poor being that can happen after you eat. And for 10 years, I rarely had a feeling of well-being. I might have had psychic satiation. I might have been emotionally satisfied. But in terms of just physically feeling energized and good and feel like I've really fueled up on something that felt good, I rarely had that. And that's what I'm concentrating on now. And that's what a few restaurants are also working towards. And that is a very good trend.
Jim, does that just mean simply eating less? I mean, going by what the Japanese would say, which is that eating to where you're 80% full so that you don't walk away from the table overstuffed. I mean, isn't that a big part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, well, here's my trick with that. Every time you've ever eaten in your life, there's been a point where you said, should I have more? And the usual answer is, Yeah. You know, but the thing is, no one in the history of humanity has ever asked themselves that question when they were still hungry. It's the sign that you're full. As soon as you ask yourself that question, drop the fork, and what you won't eat will be about 10% of the calories that you would have eaten. Most people are 10% overweight, so there it goes right there. And also, that's the calories you're going to enjoy the least because you're not hungry anymore. Well, for sure.
Have you had to train yourself to do that?
No, we do it automatically. We ask ourselves, you know, should I have some more? And I've learned to answer no. So in terms of training, yeah. But you don't have to train yourself to ask the question because it just comes up normally. As soon as you hear it, drop your fork. And you will find that you are not really hungry anymore. And pretty soon you start dropping your fork earlier and earlier, and I've lost 35 pounds.
So is your new sense of well-being just all about you're feeling slimmer, you're feeling more energetic? Or is it having something to do with the kind of food that you're eating?
Well, it's not just dropping your fork. I mean, if you drop your fork after eating a banana split three times a day, that's not going to lose you much weight. But what I've really tried to do is I followed the weightlifter protocol. These guys do what they call cutting and bulking, you know, month after month,
right,
losing weight, gaining weight, losing weight. They really know what they're doing, and they've got good control, and they've got tons and tons of anecdotal evidence pooled. So their conventional wisdom is very, very good. So I've been sort of lurking in bodybuilder forums and catching on to what these guys are doing. And what they're doing is they're being really careful not to have any – it's not an Atkins thing, but they're careful not to have a carb-dominant meal. They have protein whenever they eat. And lean protein. And I, like most fat people at the time, I would have big bowls of brown rice and vegetables and feel very virtuous, not realizing that it was a glycemic bomb that would go off in my stomach and convert to sugar. You know, there's a lot of fat people out there who feel virtuous with their huge bowls of brown rice, and they're just not realizing what they're doing. The weightlifters know you balance out the protein, the carbs, and the fats. And there's websites like Fit Day where you go and you can track everything you eat, and it'll tell you what your balances. And if you're careful to do that and you eat really sort of whole foods with lowercase w and f, you just eat foods that are minimally processed, foods that still contain recognizably living ingredients, and you balance them and you drop your fork, and not only will you lose weight and your health will get better, but all of a sudden you have this unfamiliar feeling of well-being after eating. Not, oh, that was great, but more like, ah, oh, I'm ready to go. And it's wonderful. I wouldn't swap it for anything in the world.
You also sound like, Jim, you've gotten into a new exercise regimen.
Yeah, I do like a Tasmanian devil workout. Listen, my people are rotund. You know, I come from rotundity, and you know, every pound I don't gain is a pound lost.
Yeah.
So yeah. In addition to eating like with all this care, I do have to go work out every day and just go absolutely berserk.
Because that really fills the energy tank too, doesn't it? Don't you find that the more you work out, the more energized you are?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm
known as the guy in the gym sort of crumpled into a heap, you know, sitting there for 12 minutes gasping and wheezing after every workout.
I've seen you at my gym.
Yeah, I'm that guy, you know. And everybody feels kind of bad for him and asks if he wants some water. So, yeah, no, that doesn't particularly energize me. And I get sore and all that. But that's the extra that I have to do to overcome my genetic destiny.
Jim Leff is with us. When he was with us last time, we were talking about the Chow Hound. He was co-founder of ChowHound.com. Now he has sold the Chow Hound, and he's kind of had a bit of a food epiphany here. We're talking about his new healthier lifestyle. We're going to talk about some restaurant trends as well and food trends and anything else that you want to bring up as well. 800-242-2828. If you're in the metro area, 651-227-6000, nprnewsq.org, and click on Send Us a Question. So how much sense does this make to you, our listeners, what Jim's talking about here? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, DeGrazio in Glenwood. Hi, you're on Mid-Morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Hi.
Just have something to say. I hope that this isn't going to ruin the food that we have now in restaurants. I mean, for me, I want to go to a restaurant, indulge in something that I stay away from at home. You know, the big, fat, juicy burgers with the bacon and the cheese and all the nasty stuff on it. You know, that And then you walk away from there just full and go, gosh, I don't have to eat for a week. To me, when I go out to eat, that's what I look for.
Jim, how about that?
Yeah, grazie. I could not agree more. In fact, I'm really opposed to the notion that home cooks should cook like restaurants and restaurants should cook like home cooks. Each has its own purpose and meaning. You know, when I go out to a restaurant, indeed, it's to indulge. I want lasagna. I mean, these days when I'm actively trying to lose weight, I try to order a little more carefully, but for sure. But, you know, grazie, don't worry about it. It's not going away. The burgers are still going to be there. But, you know, I've learned to cook at home, and that's just, you need that balance. The lifestyle of eating out all the time is just so unhealthy.
You know, Jim, it's interesting to hear you say that we shouldn't be home cooking the way we see in restaurants and vice versa, because all of that food programming, and I want to talk about the Food Network here a little later, but so much of that is really about how you can bring that aesthetic that you get in the finest restaurants right into your home. Not realistic?
It's realistic, but it's not desirable, because the aesthetic you're getting in the finest restaurants generally begins with melting a stick of butter.
Yeah.
I mean, just about, you know, just melt a stick of butter. You know, and as Grazio says, that's great when you're dining out. That's what makes it feel like a special occasion. That's something you're not going to do at home. But, you know, people who go home and they take on, you know, the extra fat, the extra salt, the limitations, like rather than using what you have around your house, you have to go out and get these 7 ingredients to make this certain dish.
Yeah.
You know, a lack of improvisation. You know, if you're a home cook, you can be so flexible. You can change things up. You can just be capricious, you know, in what you do. And you can also be a lot healthier. And by sort of inserting yourself into the narrow channel that a restaurant chef works within, you can just do something that feels a lot better to you and tastes a lot better to you. You know, restaurants have to make the same 12 dishes all the time, and they have to use the same ingredients, and it's got to be unvarying in every way. It's got to have pushy flavors that sort of delight people who are not very subtle, you know, and it's got to be rather unhealthy. Whereas home cooking, it can just be a lot freer, better, tastier, healthier.
Do you think that's part of the problem here, that restaurants are not experimental enough?
Well, they are, but I mean, there's only one restaurant I've ever been to where they cook every dish different every time. Differently.
Where
every
is
time.
That?
It's called Spicy Mina. It's in Woodside, Queens, New York. It's the best Bangladeshi restaurant. It's like your mother's the best home chef in her county in Bangladesh, and she's cooking for you after a 20-year hiatus. You know, it's just like fantastic. But every dish is different every time. And if you go to Chowhound and look at the discussion about it, you'll see a lot of people can't stand the place because they say it's so inconsistent. It's because they fall in love with one version and then they do another version. Restaurants have to be consistent to stay in business. That's the whole thing. Sort of like Holiday Inn, you know, needs to provide that consistent experience from coast to coast. Restaurants have to, in order to brand themselves, they need to always provide more or less the same experience. The menu could shift, but as long as you're making spaghetti carbonara, people expect the spaghetti carbonara you make.
Yeah, that's really about the expectations of the diners, right? The restaurant
totally.
Might want to do it differently,
oh, they,
but
are you
we,
kidding?
The diners, expect this.
I just imagine the chefs weeping bitter tears that they're just locked into having to do it the same way every time, but they have to. It's economically imperative. But we as home chefs are free. So this whole thing of trying to cook like you're in a restaurant is sort of like a voluntary incarceration.
To the phones to Phil in Dual County, South Dakota. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
Hey.
My wife and I are unwilling to risk $20. She says can't afford it on a meal that maybe you like and you don't like. Oh, hey, by the way, Mr. Jim, I just had a piece of pie, home-picked apricots and rhubarb on a whole wheat crust of flour I ground yesterday morning.
Oh, my
wow,
God.
Phil, that sounds good.
Yeah,
I'm in a reverie.
And the ice cream came from Iowa. I can't make ice cream. Okay.
Wow.
So your original point was, Phil?
Oh, buffets.
Yeah.
We'd rather go to a buffet where you can try a lot of different stuff for one price, but they seem to be dying out. Three buffets have died that we liked in 6 months. And one was sort of a seedy Chinese place that the health department shut down, probably should have, but...
Phil, you really think you can get good food at a buffet?
Oh, golly, the Atlantic Buffet and Mongolian Barbecue down Bloomington, we were saving all day last trip to Minneapolis.
All right.
We got down there, and it's closed. It's being turned into a sushi bar, and we're just brokenhearted. So,
Jim, Jim, come on. You got to get in here on buffets.
Good. Phil, right? Yeah. Phil, make your own buffet. Life can be a buffet. Have a bite here, a bite there. Just get some energy. You sound like an energetic guy. Get in your car, get on foot, get on your bike, and go to a bunch of little places you never tried before, and just go in and try a thing here and a thing there. Make your own buffet. It's a lot better.
Jim Leff is with us. If you've just tuned into Mid Morning, we're talking about his days as a chow hound and now his days after, before and after life as a chow hound here. We're talking about healthy eating. We'll talk a bit about some restaurant trends here. I was asking him about fresh produce. You weigh in with the way you eat these days as well. Are you noticing anything changing out there about food? I'd be interested to hear that. 800-242-2828. If you're listening in the metro area, you want to join in, 651-227-6000. If you're online today, nprnewsq.org, and click on Send Us a Question to Glenn in Minneapolis. Hi, Glenn.
Oh, hi.
Hey.
Hey, it's fun to be on the radio. What surprises me about restaurants these days is the preponderance of cheese, and it's not good cheese. It's just cheese that's fat, and it covers everything from your sandwich to your pasta to your chicken.
Yeah.
And so I order everything without cheese, which they get right about half the time,
right?
Because they can't believe somebody ordered it without the cheese.
And my
daughter said to me the other day, Dad, don't you like cheese? I said, I love good cheese, but this isn't good cheese. This is just fat.
Right. So, and I don't want it everywhere. I don't want ubiquitous cheese. Yeah. No, Glenn, you're so right. And, you know, much of the country, you cannot go in a restaurant and find a dish that doesn't have cheese in it. I mean, I found that out on my chow tour. I would just, like, look at menus and try to pick out the thing that doesn't have cheese in it. Nothing, shrimp cocktails in some places have cheese. I mean, it's just all the salads have cheese. You're right, Glenn. It's over the top. I don't know what's going on with that, but you're absolutely correct in picking out that trend.
Jim, I find another trend, well, this isn't really even a trend. This has been going on for years. Everything's oversalted. It's like we've, and I kid my husband about this too, like we've kind of lost the taste for salt, so they have to add more and more and more so that the person who's eating it thinks it has been seasoned.
And the same for herbs as well. I mean, we're using so many more herbs and spices than we used to. So what chefs are doing now is really clobbering it just to make an effect. You see, we got some flavor there. You taste the rosemary?
Yeah.
You taste it? You know, and they put tons of it in, and the salt restaurant cooking these days is pushy cooking because they all want to get noticed. Because, you know, the basic dynamic that's going on in a restaurant is I'm giving you about $3 worth of ingredients, but I'm charging you like $20 for it.
Is that really true?
Look, I'm not an economist. You can argue with the figures, but the basic point is the same. We're marking up. So how do we earn that value? We earn that value by giving you a premium experience. So the cheapest, fastest, easiest way to give a premium experience is to put a lot of fat, a lot of salt, and a big clobber of herbs, cook pushy. And that's just another reason why I'm not a big supporter of home cooks trying to cook like restaurant cooks.
Yeah.
Home cooks can be more subtle.
From Nathan here, who heard you talk about brown rice, he says, I thought brown rice was supposed to be healthy. Why did the guest say this is a sugar bomb?
Here's the big surprise. Look on a table of glycemic food value, which is what diabetics use, but we should all be also looking at. Basically, what this is how fast does the body use the starch and convert it to sugar? And you'll be surprised to find that brown rice is really almost as glycemic as white rice.
Wow.
So while you do get a little bit of protein from the fiber, from the germ, and you do get a little bit of fiber, you're still having a starch bomb in your stomach. I used to eat tons of brown rice. Listen, this is my dieting thing. A lot of people in my generation would do this. Big thing of brown rice, big thing of vegetables. You got no protein, you got all starch, it's all high glycemic starch, and it just explodes into sugar in your stomach and sends ripples forward in your day because you get hungry later and need to snack. And then you really overindulge in your next meal. But if you balance it out and you put some protein and you eat lower glycemic foods like sweet potatoes, like kasha, things like that, al dente pasta, then you'll find that you no longer have cravings, you no longer feel snacky, and you can eat much more moderate portions and be satisfied.
Jim, how about whole grain bread versus white bread? I always feel better when I'm eating, brown bread, but is it really better?
It's lower glycemic, and it's certainly a lot healthier. Look for fiber and protein. That's what you look for. It's got to be fiber and protein, preferably 5 grams of each. Trader Joe's has a good one. Milton's has a total whole wheat. But also watch out. A lot of brown bread just has food coloring in it.
Really?
And they list whole wheat flour on their ingredients, but the next ingredient would be white flour.
Huh.
So look at the fiber. Look at the protein. Don't look at the color.
Jim Leff is here. We're going to take a break for news. When we come back, more of your calls and your questions. If you're holding, stay with us. If you're trying to get in and you're getting a busy signal, call back. We want to hear your question and your observations about the kind of food that you're eating these days, the trends that you're seeing in the restaurants. And if you watch the Food Network, we're going to talk about that on the other side of news. I'd be curious about your ideas on that. Michael Pollan recently wrote about it in the New York Times. I want Jim's impressions as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Can't get in by phone? You can join us online, nprnewsq.org, and click on Send Us a Question. Back in just a minute.
Programming is supported by the Minnesota State Fair, presenting An Evening with Jackson Browne at the Minnesota State Fair Grandstand, Monday, August 31st. Ticket information at mnstatefair.org.
On the new nprnewsq.org, we have more ways to go in depth. I'm meteorologist Paul Huttner. I write about weather and what's causing it. Read Updraft on nprnewsq.org, Minnesota's new online source for news that matters.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Perry Finelli. Lawmakers have been finding themselves on the defensive in town hall meetings about health care reform this summer. Today, President Obama wades in. He'll hold one in Portsmouth, New Hampshire this afternoon to highlight how his proposals would affect workers whose employers provide their health insurance. Eunice Kennedy Shriver died early today at the age of 88 with her husband, her 5 children, and all 19 of her grandchildren at her side. She may have been best known as the founder of the Special Olympics. She had suffered a series of strokes in recent years. Kuwaiti authorities say they have arrested 6 Kuwaitis linked to Al-Qaeda, who were planning to attack the main U.S. base in that country. The Interior Ministry says the 6 have given detailed confessions about plans to bomb the camp, as well as the headquarters of the country's security agency and other facilities. 2 studies suggest a new osteoporosis drug may lower the risk of bone fractures as well as or better than current medicines. The genetically engineered drug is made by Amgen and is designed specifically to block one pathway involved in the natural breakdown of bone cells. A Duluth man infected with the AIDS virus is charged with not telling his girlfriend about his disease before they had sex. 39-year-old Jesse Tuff's girlfriend told police she learned Tuff was HIV positive when she read an email he got from his ex-wife. The woman says she has tested negative for HIV. Sunny skies for the state today. High temperatures will range from the middle 80s to lower 90s. Right now in the Twin Cities, the skies are sunny and the temperature is 76 degrees. It's 10:33. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
We're back on Mid-Morning on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Carrie Miller. Coming up on midday at 11, Education Commissioner Alice Segrin is in the studio to talk about the latest school report cards, which show nearly half of the state's schools failing to meet the standards of No Child Left Behind. At noon, a Chautauqua Institution lecture about the prospects for Middle East peace by Aaron David Miller. Did you catch our Woodstock show yesterday? If you didn't, it's in the archives. If you're a music lover, that's a show for you. And Friday at 10 is a show for you as well. Bella Fleck is going to be in the Maude Moon Weyerhaeuser studio. He's the subject of this great new documentary. I've seen it, coming out soon. It's about this trip that he took to Africa where he found native musicians, and basically they just started jamming and playing. Great film. He's bringing his banjo to Studio M. Should be an excellent conversation. He's going to perform. We'll listen to some of the music from the documentary. That's Friday at 10. Bella Fleck in the Maude Moon Weyerhaeuser studio. And I hope you will be listening in as well. Hope you're with us this morning as we talk with Jim Leff. He's co-founder of the Chow Hound. It's now owned by CBS, and he has found a new way of eating. Do you miss the Chow Hound at all, Jim? Do you miss those days at all?
You mean of the eating part or of the website?
Well, the eating part and then all the blogging and then all the interaction with the people around the country.
Well, the interaction, I was mostly a janitor for 3 million compulsive eaters. You know, I mean, wonderful people who shared wonderful information, and I still stop in at the site all the time. I love it. Yeah. As far as chowding itself, I don't know. You know, I've just discovered this seventh flavor of well being that comes from eating well and balancing what I eat, and I just. I don't know. I don't miss having multiple cereal lasagnas, you know.
To the phones to Kathy in Winona. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hey.
This is such a great conversation because I think so many people are reexamining how they're eating. And it seems to me, I mean, my husband and I have definitely gone through a whole sort of revolution, locavore, whole foods kind of thing. And it's kind of like changing your palate to not exactly a foreign cuisine, but, I mean, we grew up on processed foods. And they taste good. So we have to kind of condition ourselves to not like that stuff anymore. But if you stick with it, the processed foods don't even sound good, don't even taste good anymore.
Yeah, when you talk about processed foods, Kathy, Michael Pollan's written a lot about this, Jim, where he kind of has this thing that he says about, you know, make sure there is real food in what you're eating, that something can be defined as real food. I think that's kind of caught on.
Yeah, and that's the germ of his message, and that's also the best part of his message. It's just so true. Just eat your way earlier on the food chain with everything, you know? I mean, cheese, farm-fresh cheese is a good thing. You know, shake cheese in a bottle is less of a good thing. You know, frozen mozzarella on a lousy frozen pizza. You know, the further it gets from being alive, the worse. Now, that doesn't mean I'm one of these raw foods people who everything's got to be uncooked and alive. That's going a little too extreme. But the less people screw around with it and turn it into other things and make it convenient, generally the healthier and also the cheaper it is.
You know, it sounded like you had some reservations about some of the other things that Pollan thinks about and writes about food, do you?
Well, I haven't examined his stuff enough to give you an authoritative thing. Some things resonate more than others. Your caller mentioned conditioning yourself to dislike processed foods. I don't know if that's necessary. I don't think it has to be anti like that. You know, again, I love potato chips and cornflakes, and those are pretty processed. The trick is let's not make those the focus of our diet. You know, let's not swing the pendulum back too far the other way. Just slowly start eating better. You know, that's all you have to do. And once you do, inertia builds up, and then you can decide for yourself exactly how far you want to go. But I'm with Grazio, who called earlier and said, you know, he still wants to be able to go out and eat a big, fat bacon cheeseburger. Yeah, that's not sinful. Let's not turn this into like a religious thing.
Well, while we're talking about Pollan, let me just read something from this piece that he wrote in the New York Times about Julia Child and the legacy of Julia Child and the Food Network. And I have to admit, I watch some of the shows on the Food Network, and I'm a terrible cook, so what's my excuse? Here's what he says. The Food Network can now be seen in nearly 100 million American homes, and on most nights commands more viewers than any of the cable news channels. I did not know that. But here's what I don't get, he says. How is it that we're so eager to watch other people browning beef cubes on screen, but so much less eager to brown them ourselves? What do you think the answer is to that, Jim?
Vicarious everything. It's, you know, we're not living in the world anymore. It's world, you know. Everything's vicarious. People get more passive. They, you know, I mean, a lot of the people posting, you know, 12 hours a day on Chowhound are very busy people for whom that's what they do with their little bit of leisure time. We need to find a way to use our leisure time for things that are constructive for us rather than just this sort of entertainment vicarious experience.
Okay, let me give you a more uplifting theory here. I think people are interested in the creative process. I do think they're interested in listening to how chefs think, listening to how writers think, musicians, artists. I think that's part of the, at least that's part of the interest for me. I want to know what makes these people tick that are the best in the business.
Yeah, process. You're absolutely right. I agree.
You're buying that.
Totally.
All right. To the phones to Jonathan in Golden Valley. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello.
Hey.
Say, I was calling to make a comment. I call it eating with my eyes, and that means everything that goes on my plate, I look and I know the portions. If it's things I make, I already know the amount, so I put it on there, and then it'd be extremely rare that I would have any more than what goes on the plate in the first place. And if I'm somewhere like, oh, we have this national night out, and, of course, there was a bunch of different things that people have made, I would survey everything first and determine how much of each would go on the plate.
You didn't just dive in
exactly,
and stuff
so
it in.
Exactly, so that I would know how much would be there and the like. And so that's the way I've done that, and I've done that since, over 30 years anyway.
And that works for you?
Yeah, it works great. And I used to be overweight as a kid, and I've never had to go on but the one diet.
Jim, that makes sense?
Yeah. Yeah, Jonathan, that works for you, and that's great. Everybody's got to find the thing that works for them. For me, I mean, people have always said, you know, leave a little food on your plate. There's all these things that you do, you know, chew everything 23 times, and you know, all these things you do to sort of regulate your behavior. I find that the only thing that works for me is listening for that question of, should I have more? And that allows me to be more flexible in places where I am not providing my own portions. And also, it allows me to shrink back because, Jonathan, you've been eating the same portion size for years now. But if you were answering that question instead, you may actually be shrinking back. And if you're just slightly overweight, you could lose the extra 5 pounds or whatever, you know, because when you start asking yourself if you should have another bite, you start hearing that question earlier and earlier in the meals.
You know, Jim, this is reminding me of one of my favorite guests when we talk about food is Brian Wansink. He does research at Cornell. Have you ever read anything that he's written about this?
No, but I will.
He's up at the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, and he's constantly doing what I consider to be these diabolical experiments about why we eat the way we do and why we eat the amounts that we do. And he finds, you know, the ambience of a restaurant, the name of the restaurant, the names of things on the menu, everything contributes to trying to influence people to eat more and think they're having a more satisfying experience. And if you remove some of that, you really kind of lay bare a lot of the smoke and mirrors around the way we eat.
Exactly right. And it's not just consumption of food. It's consumption in general. I mean, you're
right.
Just talking about marketing theory. It's,
right.
It's the sizzle as well as the steak. And for sure, you can break it all down. And the best way to do it, I find, is not by imposing external restrictions like Jonathan's talking about, but by listening more internally to your own reactions to things and just, you know, paying a little more attention.
Yeah, he buys into that. To the phones to Maureen in St. Cloud. Hi, Maureen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I have to tell you that I'm a self-admitted foodie, so I do watch the Food Channel a lot.
Okay.
But I have to disagree a little bit with this because although there are plenty of programs on that teach you how to do techniques and things that normal people wouldn't do in the kitchen, I find that there are several programs that offer very low-cost meals and give you many options. So let's say you don't have one thing in your kitchen. They'll say, well, you could use this if you have it around. So I like the idea of being able to look at the food that's being made, and I find that my kids will eat things that look more attractive.
Really?
And I've gotten many great ideas from the Food Network as well as other programs. So I don't really have a question. It was more a comment that I think everybody can use things like the Food Network to do bad things for their diet, but you can also use them to make really healthful and delicious choices.
Jim, you ever watch the Food Network?
Not a whole lot, but just I don't watch much TV in general. But I think your caller is right. I mean, you know, this, if you're not that into food or savvy about food or whatever you want to call it, and you start absorbing more information, then it naturally piques your curiosity and makes you more attentive to what you're doing. And that's a great way in. The only thing is, you know, you might want to look beyond that to other sources, like going out and checking out food of different ethnicities and, you know, meeting Puerto Rican grandmas and Laotian grandmas and finding out how things are done. Yeah, because, and you can get to a much deeper place with it. But sure, the Food Network's great for getting people who are just eating cold cuts to, you know, really thinking about what they're doing, eating more healthily and more enjoyably.
You know, that's one of the things that you did do in Chowhound that sounded fun. You would roam neighborhoods and you'd look into little alleys and corners for, you know, these little dive places where there would be great food. Do you still do some of that?
You bet. I mean, that's what the whole site is about. You know, rather than eat where you're told, you know, rather than go to these shiny, spotlit places that everybody says, oh, you've got to try, they're to die for. You know, rather than do that, you just sort of push away the misdirection the magician's offering you, and you just go in the other direction. And, you know, that little place you pass on your way to work that you've always wondered about, go in, try it, check it out. As you do so, you build up considerable wisdom. I reached a point at one point where almost every place that I thought looked good was good. It was this dependable radar, this chowdar that and you can just have the best experiences because you make your own discoveries and you can find hyper deliciousness right on the very block you live just if you just eat around a little more and check stuff out.
How do you develop a sophisticated chowdar, do you think?
Doing it. Just doing it. You know, if you put anything a human being puts his attention on, you know, over a period of time, he's going to get a lot better at it and get some perceptions. And I think I might have put a little too much attention on it. But, you know, it definitely paid off, you know, in terms of finding great stuff. And, you know, that's the fun thing to do. I mean, people wonder how I acquired all my knowledge of food all over the city and all over the country. It's just, you know, I would never stop for the same muffin twice. You know, most people get their breakfast muffin in the same place every morning. I go a mile out of my way and try another place.
You know, I'm reading this book by Mike Steinberger. He writes about food and wine. You familiar with him?
Oh, sorry, no.
He's got a book that has come out about France and the standards of food in France. And basically, his book says they are so past it. You know, Spain and Great Britain and the United States have just far surpassed the quality of food in France, and they still don't get it. Now, have you traveled internationally?
Tons, yeah.
So what's your perception of that?
I kind of agree. You know, the good stuff is always where you least expect, you know, and the places that have the reputations, you know, generally don't deserve them. Like, we think that Manhattan's got great Jewish delis and pizza, and it just doesn't. Like, none. There's none, you know. It's just these outdated notions. Things are changing and shifting all the time, and you just, you know, I learned to stop listening to conventional wisdom and just sort of make my own and built a website so a few million other people could do likewise.
Jim Leff is with us. He's the former Chow Hound. We're talking about some new ideas that he has discovered for eating. I'm asking you if you're noting some food trends, making some changes in your own life about this. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 to Vanessa in Boyceville, Wisconsin. Hi, Vanessa. Thanks for waiting.
No problem.
Your question.
Well, actually, I have just a few comments.
Sure.
I spent about a decade in the restaurant business, anything up from, you know, busser to manager, and it's all smoke and mirrors, you know. If the chef has to pour on a pound of spice, just know that it's a cheap cut of meat.
Huh.
You know, it's really not a mystery, you know. It's what people eat. Americans like fat and sugar. They put on fat and sugar.
Yeah.
Now I'm a dietetic student. I'm a senior year dietetic student with Jacksonville State University in Alabama. And Jim is on point with everything he's saying. You know, you don't need to cut out carbs. Carbs are good. You have to have them. But you got to combine them with protein and fat. It's absolutely necessary. And plus, it tastes better.
So Vanessa, as you've gone through this program to be a dietetic student, are you having to really rethink? Are you originally from the South?
I'm originally from Wisconsin.
Okay, because you sound like you had a little Southern accent. But think of the way people eat in the South. Have you had to kind of rewrite the rules for yourself about everything you thought you knew about food?
Well, I grew up in a very country area with vegetables right out of the garden, and I've always loved that. Unfortunately, a lot of people have never been so fortunate, and they really, you know, you think it's common sense, but there's a lot of people that just really don't know. They just, you know, we're just so far away from that. You know, Mom used to garden and can and cook, and, you know, it's just not a lifestyle we have anymore, so we're just having to consciously relearn everything.
Yeah, Jim, you think that's true, that people just really don't know?
Yeah. You know, we've forgotten. And just what Vanessa's talking about, I wonder if everybody else is drifting into a reverie like me with, you know, Mom's home-cooked vegetables. God, you know, that's the way it was for thousands and thousands of years. It's only in the last 50 years we've gotten into this bubble. And I just want to re-key the point Vanessa made. You know, if you put some protein with every meal, some good lean protein, be it almond butter or tofu or nuts or, you know, low-fat chicken or nice lean steak, whatever, ground turkey, if you put a little protein with everything you eat, you will be amazed at how much better you feel, how less snacky craving you get, and how much more sort of regulated your eating gets. It gets less out of control, less unconscious, less crazy.
Are you really eating a lot of tofu?
Good tofu made by this like genius guy who works in a Korean market in Queens. And he's like a religious monk and nobody knows it. Everybody just thinks he's like the little guy who makes the tofu. But
really?
I'm aware. Yeah, he has almost an observable halo. And the tofu he makes is ambrosia. You can eat it straight out of the tub.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I'm not just being whimsical here. If you're going to do what I'm talking about and try to eat more simply and more whole foods, you also have a responsibility to find stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because the simpler you eat, the more careful you have to be in your ingredients and your preparation to make sure there's still some flavor and love in it. Because, you know, just if you take out the fat and you take out the sugar and the salt and the spices, you know, you're working without a net, you know? You know, there's not a lot to fall back on. So you start to have to be a little bit more careful. And I'm not talking about being snobby and spending a lot of money on your ingredients and getting rich ingredients, but just more careful ingredients because they stick out a lot more, which is what Vanessa was saying about the smoke and mirrors.
Here's Sarah in Minneapolis. She says it's frustrating to look at a kid's menu and see nothing but fried food, pasta, and pizza. It'd be nice to see some healthier options for kids. That is so true, isn't it?
And all that soda. God, the soda. Ugh.
What do you do about that, Jim? I mean,
jeez,
if you're taking your kids out to restaurants.
Yeah, I just get them to be chowhounds, like expose them to good food, food with love in it, you know, food with love in it. If it's got love in it, it's not going to do you that much harm.
From Jen in East Bethel, she says, once I hit 30, simple carbs went right to my middle. Limiting carbs to ones I relish, like potato chips, is key. Mm. She says, I do fine without white bread. You clearly still indulge, Jim. Because you were talking about chips.
Yes, but not as a lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, that's the trick, not as a lifestyle. And also in moderation, you know. The other thing that I got from the weightlifter diet is not just mixing carbs, fats, and proteins and balancing them, but also having small meals frequently, never a big meal. You know, fat people always think that if they're having this great big bowl of food, it's okay as long as it's low fat and low cal. No, you will not lose weight.
You are fun, Jim, let me tell you.
Well, look, if you're having a really good meal like five times a day, four times a day of, you know, really good food but modest, you will very, very quickly snap into the habit of doing that. And it'll feel okay because the big bowls of food, even the low-cal stuff is not going to work.
So are you eating four or five times a day? Is that what you're on?
Whenever possible, you know, I try to do it as much as I can, but I never eat a pure carb meal anymore. And I used to feel virtuous. I mean, fat people feel like protein is fattening. I don't know why. There's this hypnosis that happens to fat people. I was one of them. You know, you feel like protein is bad and you're very virtuous if you're not eating protein. Wrong. You don't want to go the other way and turn Atkins. I don't know what that is, the whole Atkins thing. Balance it. Have some protein at every meal. And with the carbohydrates, when I say carbohydrates, I don't mean like, you know, like Lipton's cup of soup. You know, I try to eat a little bit better than that. But take a look at a glycemic table. You can find them all over the internet, and you'll see which ones are high glycemic. Anything high glycemic, it's a simplification, but you can imagine it turning to sugar in your stomach. And you just ask yourself, do I want that much sugar in my body?
So when you're cooking, Jim, and it sounds like you're doing a lot more cooking of your own, are you relying on cookbooks, or are you really just doing a lot of experimentation?
No cookbooks, because again, cookbooks are that whole inflexible mindset and being punchy and all that stuff. No, I cook like, you know, geranimals, like modular, mix and match. I have my proteins, I have my fats, my carbohydrates, but then first of all, they're really good ones, you know, because I'm careful and I pick them out and I get really good ones. But then I combine them imaginatively and based on how I feel that very moment, what do I feel like eating? I feel like I'm so much more indulgent now than I used to be.
Really?
Because if I go to a restaurant, I don't order what I feel like. I order what the restaurant's good at. I'm a chowhound, you know, and that's not always what I feel like eating. But if I cook for myself, I can have it exactly the way I want it. And that's awesome.
Let me take a call here from Lori in Watertown, South Dakota. Hi, Lori.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, I have a question and a couple comments.
Sure.
Question, I know you had touched on the brown rice, but what about like they have the wheat, like spaghetti noodles and whatnot.
Whole wheat pasta, yeah.
Whole wheat pasta. And then also just a couple comments. One, a previous caller talked about their kids eating better if it looks good. I have found, too, that, you know, if I make pork chops with potatoes, I'll have like broccoli or green beans. To add some color in there, I wouldn't have like corn or something that's bland color-wise. And then also, I have tried to incorporate into my kids that serving size, if we have a box of something they want to snack on, that they get a little plastic baggie and they take the serving size and put the baggie rather than taking the whole bag of chips or the whole box of vanilla wafers and sticking their hand and munching that way, because obviously you probably end up eating, what, 2 to 3 times more if you...
Right, if you're just taking it out of the bag.
Dipping in there.
So, yeah, that's so true.
I want to ask Jim about the whole wheat pasta, Lori. I'm interested in that. Is that good, Jim?
Yeah, whole wheat pasta is you know, it's got some fiber and it's got some protein, but not much. You know, think about it. How much is in there? So, like, be careful when you're at the supermarket and you see products that claim to be healthy because they put, like, you know, a milligram of spinach in it. You know, just be a little bit wary and skeptical and look at the ingredients carefully. But yeah, I mostly eat whole wheat pasta myself. But again, it's incumbent on you. Whole wheat pasta doesn't taste as good as regular pasta unless it's a really good brand. So you just got to look around. You got to be a Chowhan. You got to find the good stuff and you have to work a little harder. Because again, you know, if you're sacrificing the easy, quick way to deliciousness in favor of something deeper, then you have to work a little harder.
Do you find that your definition, which I would think you honed over many, many years of what is truly delicious, has pretty radically changed, Jim?
Well, yeah, I no longer feel as satisfied when I have a great big honking plate of lasagna. I enjoy it as much as I enjoyed it before, but my perceptions are broader and wider, and I'm more aware of what I'm missing. And what I'm missing is like an hour experience of H-O-U-R experience of lasagna,
yeah,
rather than the immediate experience. As it goes down your throat is a very narrow experience, but as it digests and you move through your day is a much wider, broader experience. And if it's not making you feel good, something's missing. And that doesn't mean that there can't be things missing sometimes. I still eat lasagna and like it, but I recognize that something's missing.
So with lasagna, you've mentioned lasagna throughout the hour.
I love lasagna.
Yeah, I do too. Would that be your last meal?
Wow, my last meal. Yeah, because I wouldn't have to worry about how I'd feel after.
But you love lasagna that much, huh?
Yeah, I'd crumble up some potato chips on it, I think.
That sounds delicious. What a nice note to end on, right? After all this talk about healthy food.
Yeah.
Lasagna and potato chips on top. Jim, this has been great. It's always great to talk with you, and I'll be checking out the website and the blog.
My pleasure, Carrie. Thanks so much.
Jim Leff with us. He's co-founder of the Chowhound. It's now owned by CBS, and he is blogging, well, really about anything that comes into his head. I was checking out his blog yesterday. So you can find a link for that on the mid-morning page at nprnewsq.org. Coming up tomorrow morning at 9, we're talking about what home ownership may look like in this country as we emerge from the recession. Very interesting ideas about how, with the tanking of the housing market, how things are changing and how many more of us may not own homes. We may rent and be satisfied with that. We've also got a newsmaker segment at the beginning of that hour. Elizabeth Warren is going to talk with us. She's a Harvard professor, and she has been involved in some oversight of what's happening with the financial system and banking. New report out about what's going on with toxic assets on the records, on the balance sheets of banks. So we're talking about all of that tomorrow morning at 9. At 10, your ethical dilemmas up for consideration. Randy Cohen is with us. He writes the ethicist column for the New York Times. This is always a fun show. Randy, wow, I have been reading some of the things that Randy has been weighing in on the New York Times, and they've really been putting him through his paces. So he's going to be with us tomorrow at 10. Your opportunity as well to get some expert advice about your ethical dilemmas. That's tomorrow at 10. Please check out the mid-morning book page. There's information there about how to become a member of my book club. And if you're already in, we've got, I don't know, somewhere around 180, close to 200 people in the club. There is information there about our upcoming show. You received your copy of The Diary of Anne Frank. That was this month's book selection, July's really. Talking about that book on Thursday at 10 o'clock. So I hope you can make a date to be with us for that conversation Thursday at 10. This is Mid-Morning.